This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
As you speak, live translation provides a spoken translation of what you say to the other caller.
Hey, I'm about 20 minutes away.
Je suis à environ 20 minutes.
When your friend responds, their words are translated for you.
So live real-time translation technology, it's hit the market. You can now listen to someone speak in another language and have a conversation translated in real time. So will this be helpful? Is this simply a helpful tool? Or will the incentive, the process, the love of learning a language be lost? Do you currently learn a language through technology? Would you use technology like this? And do you even learn a second language at all? Our number's 1-300-222-774. And later this hour, we're going to cross to the United States because one woman is asking, why does it cost so much to be a bridesmaid? That once simple question of will you be my bridesmaid is now not so simple, and the expectations, the duties, and the cost of being a bridesmaid have become over the top. If that's your experience, 1-300-222-774.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So will you use real-time translation? That technology has hit the market. And will it de-incentivise you from learning a language? And do you learn a language? How do you learn a language? Why do you learn a language? John Hadjiak, Professor at the University of Melbourne School of Language and Linguistics. John, I'm going to just take a stab in the dark and say that you mightn't be a fan of these live, real-time translation pieces of tech that are now hitting the market.
You have to be very careful. We can't rely on technology. Do you remember we had the self-driving car? That was going to change the way we drove everything. They had to withdraw them from the market because technology does wonderful things, but it doesn't replace human supervision, human involvement. That's the risk.
Are people learning languages now? I don't know whether you have the stats on how many people are choosing to, for whatever reason it may be, learn a second language.
The numbers, probably many more people are learning a language now. They're using technology, they're using apps, Duolingo and various other things that they're learning languages with. The issue is it takes you to a certain point, but it doesn't take you beyond.
So these new live real-time translation pieces of tech, whether they be, pods that you pop into your ears, how will they impact how we communicate with each other? Especially because there's been times, for example, where you may not speak the same language as someone, but you do find ways to communicate strangely, only to a certain degree. But what will be lost and what will be gained from this type of technology?
It'll make things easier for sure. When you're travelling overseas, and it's obviously you're going from country to country, you won't have the possibility, but you do lose the human element. And I have to say, I have used this technology recently in China, and I can tell you, it didn't work. And we had to resort to hand signals and various other things. So you have to be very careful.
We are. Can you speak Chinese?
No, not at all. I know a few words. But the thing is, we have this blind faith in technology, and we don't understand what the limitations are.
Learning another language and learning through technology, we now have real time tech that will translate for you. Will this be beneficial, John, do you think, in time, say, like hospital settings if you're travelling overseas and the basics? Is that sort of where it's at?
It'll help with those kinds of things. Again, it's not something that you would recommend. We did a big study for the Victorian government. We looked at emergency translations. It gives you the impression of working perfectly, but actually when we checked to see what was going on, we discovered there were lots of big mistakes. It was saying the opposite of what we thought it was saying. So our advice was you only use machine translation on its own when you absolutely have to. Always have everything checked by a human.
Gary's in Oakley. Morning, Gary.
Hi, I agree completely. I've studied languages over the years, and I've been lucky enough to I did a presentation in French in Montreal when I was working for a government organization many years ago. And actually by doing the, so got the Alliance Française to check the presentation. By doing the presentation, being able to speak French, you get access to information and people are more willing to cooperate with you, which you can't do using a translation. And then many years ago, I was in Paris and I also speak Russian. And this Polish lady got separated from her tour group and was standing outside a metro and came up to me and said, "Can you help me?" So over a few hours, went to police station, translated in from French into English, and then translated back into Russian, which she didn't want to speak. I said, "I don't speak Polish." Being able to do that, you can help people out. So you can't do that. It's really difficult being able to do that using a translator. And you just learn so much by immersing yourself in languages.
How many languages do you speak, Gary?
These days, mainly French, Russian, and Mandarin, and I also studied German, Swedish, Finnish, and a few others in the past.
Wow. Can I ask why? Just for a love of it?
Yeah. No. Well, basically, so we actually don't just look at Anglo-Saxon view of the world, and you get access to so much other information, and it really just helps. I mean, I've used it for research when I was studying at uni and when I did master studying. It just helps you access information. And when I was a teenager, I, you know, was starting to learn German and stuff, and I sent letters to the United Nations. I used to find pen friends for you in that day, and it was hysterical. I got a reply from an East German border guard in German. He wanted to, and he wrote in English, and and I'm going, I don't really know if I want to reply this, but anyway, I got a couple of letters. But he was from Dresden, and he sent me postcards and stuff, knowing that it had all been censored. And he was from Dresden, and they put, in that time, they put the border guards on the wall in East Germany from outside of Berlin, so they didn't have any connections with the West. And also, he said, "I learnt my English listening to American Armed Forces radio," and I thought, this is interesting.
Gary, what an enigma you are. Has it helped you, and have you noticed that you do look at things differently when you read something in another language?
It does, but I have to say a lot of people get incredibly jealous and want to destroy you because you're different from everyone else.
Gary's idea of being able to see someone else's perspective, John, would you agree with that?
Totally. Look, there's very good research showing that that effect of learning another language starts very, very young. If you Google it, if you look up on The Economist, they report a recent study in which small children, I think they were 4 or 5 years old, and they compared children who had been exposed to learning another language or not, and they found that the children who were learning another language were actually much more empathetic and going out of their way to assist the other person that they were interacting with. That's a really, really important outcome.
If you grow up in a bilingual household, do you hold on to that second language, those two languages, for most of your life, or is it something you need to work really hard at? You know, you hear a lot of families that say, we choose to only speak Greek or Mandarin at home so that that language isn't lost and is passed down through the generations. Is that still happening?
It's like any skill, any capacity that you have, use it or you lose it. It will be there. It's always embedded in there. Sometimes it might, you can stick electrodes in and prod and you'll get that knowledge back. It actually is very easy to activate. And the great thing about learning and speaking another language is it's the lifelong health benefits. Repeated studies show that active bilinguals, they delay the onset of dementia by about 4.5 years. Now, we could save billions on our health system simply by getting people to learn another language. It's very low cost, very effective, and it transforms people, and it's got proven health benefits.
Jeffrey's in Oakley. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
Very well. What did you want to say?
I just said I've actually learned Hindi probably maybe 30 years ago. I actually did 2 years at the Trove Uni, did in Asian studies, so I've actually been read it, write it, and speak it.
And do you actively try and keep that up, Jeffrey?
Yes, I listen to Hindi songs, Hindi music all the time, and occasionally watch Hindi movies.
Music's a really good point, isn't it, actually? Is that a great way to absorb different languages, nuances, emotion when learning a language?
It's a huge motivator. I mean, that's why people learn English in the 60s, you know, in the 50s and 60s, they wanted to understand what Elvis was singing about in the Beatles. It's a huge motivator.
It's all heart loss and heartbreak. It was all the same. Patrick's in Glenmorangstown. Hi, Patrick.
G'day, Rich, and good morning to your guests. Look, my heritage is Maltese, but Malta is a bilingual country, so they speak English as well. But I can also speak Italian. I was married to an Italian woman for over 25 years. In 1991, at the height of the Balkans War, I worked for a government department in Geelong, and a Balkan refugee family was brought in to our office. They couldn't speak English. Being the only WOG in the building, they called me to come down thinking that I would have the magic touch and speak every language. However, I couldn't speak the Balkan languages, but I asked them if they spoke Italian, and they did. So there we are, this Maltese Australian speaking Italian to a couple of Balkan refugees, and we managed to sort out all their issues and get them housed. And it was just a start reminder of the importance of having that skill to speak a few other languages.
What a beautiful thing to witness, Patrick.
It was deeply moving, and I still think about it now because I think, what would have happened to those people if I'd been sick that day or not around? And it's given me a lot of opportunity. You know, just even watching wonderful movies and that from the world, because Maltese is a bit of a mongrel language, I can actually... Because it's in the middle of the Mediterranean, it's picked up words and phrases and things from all over that part of the world. And I watch what's happening in the Middle East, and I can put together what's actually being said without worrying about the subtitles, which are generally a bit misleading anyway.
So that's it.
Having one language opens up the world in so many other ways.
I love the idea that you call it a mongrel language as well, and that is said with love, and it's that little bit of a mix. Patrick, I love that story and the idea that you can mix a few languages together. Once you learn one, does it get easier?
It certainly does. The effect is cumulative. And we have to say English is a classic mongrel language, and we don't mind at all. We take words from all over the world.
We certainly do, don't we?
Yeah.
So is there a way, because this new tech, it's left, right and centre, we're seeing it all the time. There's a new form of tech that will either translate or help us learn a language through an app or through real time in our headphones. Yes, it may not be accurate all the time, but could it spark a want and a desire to learn a language?
Well, I think that's the thing. I mean, I'm not concerned about it replacing people from learning language. I'm hoping it'll encourage people to actually take up the challenge and learn a language properly, whether it's signing up for a language class and mixing with other people. We have to remember that language is about social interaction.
Mm.
That's really the critical thing. It's about building relationships. It's about getting to know each other. It's not just about words that you hear. It's much, much more.
This, I did French immersion in primary school in Canada. Our daughter's about to start Italian at Footscray Primary. We're over the moon about it. That's from Sarah. And another that says, I had to install an imported oven yesterday. All the instructions were in German. I have basic German skills, but the Translate Live was really helpful. Just hover the phone over the instructions and it changes all the words. I can see the limitations, though, when it would come to conversations. So, yeah, hopefully it doesn't replace the love to want to go and learn a language, to be able to interact with people, but maybe it just sparks that appetite, John, to learn something.
I think that's the thing we have to understand. It won't replace, it'll support.
And don't trust everything that it tells you, because it could tell you something about cannibal butter.
Yeah, no, there's a very funny story about cannibal butter. So there's in Switzerland, all products have to be labelled in at least three languages, German, French and Italian. Mm-hmm. Now, this product actually made it all the way to the shelves and was on sale. So, you know, it started off with the German, then the French and the Italian, and the original name for it was in German. It was Swiss roasting butter. And the translation into French and Italian was butter to roast Swiss people with. So you can just see that there was no human intervention, no one checked. I mean, it's quite remarkable, and it made its way all the way to the shelves before people noticed.
Did anyone buy it?
Of course they did. It became a huge hit.
Always good to see you, John. Thank you.
My pleasure.
John Hudjack is the professor at University of Melbourne School of Language and Linguistics. Still coming up later this hour, how much is it costing you both emotionally, time-wise and financially to be a bridesmaid or a maid of honour? Are you now expected to put on entire festivals? Are the days of just simply taking the girls out for a night, are they over? That's coming up a little later in the hour as well.
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So in a parent-child relationship, we think of the parent as the carer. That's what you naturally think of. But what if the child, what if the young person has to take on that role of being the carer? A new study that's come out from La Trobe University has looked at the experience of young people who have to care for a parent who is living with early onset dementia and how to best support that young person in that role. We're going to have a chat with Dr. Anna Booth in just a moment, who conducted this research. But she conducted the research because Dr. Bronwyn Morecambe, who's the National Director for Young People and Nursing Homes National Alliance, wanted to shine a spotlight on the incredible but often lonely work that these young people do in their homes. Bronwyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Lovely to be here, Rochelle.
The role of carers, we understand their importance and how emotional and how lonely that work can be. But we often think of carers maybe when we get a little older in our lives, maybe caring for an ageing parent. But you wanted to shine a spotlight on people sort of aged 16 to 25 who in particular were looking after parents with dementia. Why this cohort?
Well, it's even younger than that sometimes, when children who have a parent diagnosed with young onset dementia have to take on a parenting role. The roles are flipped. As the parent progresses with the condition, they take on more and more organising, attending appointments and so on with them. They've been forgotten though. We find that young onset dementia is still conflated with the dementias of old age, and so the services and supports for people are not there. Nor are they there for families and for children particularly who are supporting a parent with young onset dementia. So we wanted to shine a light on this and get some of those services underway.
Is it a formal arrangement or does it just naturally happen? Because if you're, everyone wants to do the best thing that they can and to help a loved one, whether it be parent, child, child, parent, does it just start out as baby steps, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in some type of formal capacity as being a carer?
With young onset dementia, it's a very gradual thing where symptoms might seem apparent to the family member, to the young person. But getting a diagnosis can be very difficult. It's often misdiagnosed initially as a mental health condition, depression, something like that. So the young person will be supporting that parent throughout a time where they may not even have a diagnosis to work from. So it's very hard, and dementia invades every part of your life, every part from health, finances, social relationships and so on. So for children particularly, it's the stigma that it comes with is absolutely all-encompassing and one of the most destructive parts.
What do you mean by stigma?
People think of dementia as something that happens to old people. It's all about memory loss and you go to a nursing home if you've got dementia. There's no understanding of the different types of dementias that affect younger people, the personality changes that can happen. So for young people, it can be very embarrassing. They commonly won't tell their friends. They do this in isolation and it can be very, very difficult, mainly the personality changes, but the other changes that the parent goes through.
Before we have a chat with Dr. Anna Booth, who I know you commissioned to shine a spotlight on the young people that you're talking about now, I could imagine that with all of the things you've just mentioned, that would change a young person's life. And if we're talking about someone kind of in your prime years, you know, 16 to 25, maybe even younger, that would impact every aspect of your social life, of those formative years, of your schooling structure,
Absolutely.
Even getting to school.
Absolutely. Sometimes you don't make it to school. Mm. The emotional load that this brings is also really significant, because this young person is watching a parent vanish before their eyes and being replaced by someone that they don't know. Many of these young people have spoken about that as one of the most challenging and horrendous things that they've got to do. They're living with a parent who's vanishing before their eyes.
1300 222 774. If this is something that you've experienced, did you have the support? Did you know where to go? Did you have those networks around you? Our number's 1300 222 774. Dr. Bronwyn Morecambe is with you, the National Director for Young People in Nursing Homes National Alliance, who called upon the services of Dr. Anna Booth, who is a research fellow in psychology and family studies at the Bouvier Centre at La Trobe University. Anna, you've worked alongside Bronwyn. What, and I guess, how many young people did you speak with, and what did they highlight with you?
Yeah, so we spoke with a group of 10 young people who were aged, 14 to 25 years of age, and they were all living with or caring for a parent with young onset dementia. And as Bronwyn's highlighted, we really found those themes coming out of just significant challenges in balancing their personal, their work and their study commitments alongside these really significant caring responsibilities at home. And this is a time when, you know, young people typically need to focus on themselves and their own development. Mm. So we really found this theme where young people were very much feeling out of sync with their peers and often putting their own plans on hold.
Were they all wanting to do it though? Was it this really torn emotional situation to be in? Because I could imagine they wouldn't want someone else to look after their parent, or maybe they did need that support. What was their general feeling around the responsibility that was given to them or that they took on?
Yeah, look, it's quite mixed, but overall, most of the young people did feel a really significant sense of responsibility to their diagnosed parent, as well as to their family overall. So, you know, this is an issue that affects obviously not just the diagnosed parent, but the other parent, if there is one, and the whole family. And, you know, these young people often had really fantastic and meaningful relationships with their diagnosed parent up until the point of diagnosis, and of course after diagnosis as well. But certainly they felt a strong sense of responsibility to be there for their parent and for the family, even though the cost was really, really huge for most of these people.
Would you like to see happen, Bronwyn? Is it around better education, support, services?
All of the above, yeah. Rochelle. I think the one of the other things we don't recognise enough is the grief that that young person goes through watching this happen before their eyes. We need to make people aware of young onset dementia, so we need GPs, health professionals, schools to be aware of what might be happening, and we need tailored supports for these young people so that they can continue to provide the care they need, but also get the care that they require as well as the parent they're looking after. So education, development of better supports and services, not just for the parent with dementia, but for the young person caring for them, and age-appropriate residential care options ultimately, I think.
Is it just expected that they'll do it?
I think it just falls on them. Mm. Often if you're dealing with something and you don't have a diagnosis yet, when you do get a diagnosis, they've been involved to such a degree that it just continues on. And I don't think anybody wants to say no, they can't. They're very keen to provide that support. But we need to step up significantly and provide the support that young person needs. At the moment, I think the focus when someone's diagnosed with young onset dementia is rightly on the individual with the condition. But in doing that, we completely forget about the impact on the family and these young carers especially. They're the future of this. They are going to be the ones that make the difference. and we need to support them as much as we can.
This, Rishanoa, a 25-year-old woman who's taking on the responsibility and power of attorney of escorting her middle-aged aunt who has dementia to appointments, etc. Other relatives are just too busy or too old. This is a lot to put onto a young person. Our number's 1-300-222-774. Dr. Bronwyn Morecambe is with you, and Dr. Anna Booth is with you as well. They've conducted some research that's looked at the role of young carers when their parent, who is young themselves, has young onset dementia. And that's the other part of this heartbreaking story too, is we're talking about kind of two young people, different scales of young,
indeed,
but both young.
Yes, absolutely. So younger people, we've had people in their 30s diagnosed with young onset dementia. So this is coming along at a prime time of life for people when they have financial responsibilities. They may even have, this is the parent with dementia, may even have older parents that they're looking after, but they commonly have a family that they're raising. So all of this comes into play, and that's why children of the parent are often called in to provide that support.
And I don't know how far down the line your research looked at, but the long-term impacts that this would have on a young person, because dementia, I mean, one of the things that makes it so hard is how long it can be, how drawn out it can be. And I wonder emotionally the impact that this has on a young person. If they've watched the decline of their parent, they haven't lived through their formative years, and then let's say maybe, well, anything could happen. The parent goes into permanent residential care, or they pass away through complications of dementia. And what then happens? What is the mental health, the emotional stability of that young person who's watched all of this?
Yeah, we see a significant emotional toll for a lot of these young people. You know, they're managing both the emotional and the practical demands of caring for or living with their parent with young onset dementia. And it's something that can certainly increase with time. You know, it's a progressive illness. Young people might be living with this happening in their family for years or decades. And certainly that can take a significant toll on people at this stage of life. It's really important to start supporting these young people at the outset, so at the point of diagnosis. If we can set up really good peer support, really good family support, all of those things certainly help to mitigate the emotional toll that young people experience.
I can imagine peer-to-peer support would be vital here, Bronwyn.
Absolutely essential, and we don't have enough of it. So peer support, particularly for school-aged children, is really important. Schools can have a very important part to play in that. But peer support, I think, for anybody supporting someone living with young onset dementia is vital. The other thing I'd say, Rochelle, is that for where the older age dementias can continue for some time, the trajectory for people living with young onset dementia is a lot shorter, sometimes just 5 to 7 years by the time of diagnosis. So it's a very concentrated, compacted situation that young people have to deal with.
How can people get help? How can they get assistance? I mean, there's a text here that says, this is something that we've gone through. My mum started showing symptoms at age 50. It's also affected my mum's sister in their 40s. I'm in my late 30s now, and I'm still unpacking the trauma that it's caused. My advice is to speak to a psychologist. It has affected so many parts of my life. Don't suffer silently. How can people help?
I think that's excellent advice to seek psychological support, but we don't have the services for these young people yet. We don't have the services for the people living with young onset dementia yet, mainly because dementia services have been developed for older people. So we have work to do to lift our game in that regard. Government has work to do. We need to get the services these young people need and get them now.
How can people access this research?
It's online. We've got it on the Alliance website at www.ypinh.org.au. It's, I think, on the La Trobe website, Anna, too, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Yep.
So a couple of places to go if you have a look for it. It's well worth a read. Anna and her team have done a fantastic job of shining a light on this very forgotten group of young people.
Congratulations to the both of you. Thank you. Dr. Anna Booth, who conducted this research, a research fellow in psychology at the Bouvier Centre at La Trobe University. And it was initiated by Dr. Bronwyn Morcombe, the National Director for Young People in Nursing Homes National Alliance. And we didn't even touch on that. I think we need to get you back another time to talk about the other work that you do, which is young people in nursing homes, which is just a huge, totally separate topic. But Bronwyn, thank you for the work that you do. Yeah, great.
Thanks.
All right, we'll be in touch. Absolutely.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So remember the movie Bridesmaid and all of the emotion and the competition, and it was hilarious slash slightly frightening, that particular movie. And there was just scene after scene where we went, oh, imagine if that was true. Let me take you back.
What are we doing for the bachelorette party?
What about, like, a princess theme?
Versace meets the gold rush.
I'm thinking tanned gentlemen that swallow fire and wear sarongs.
Female fight club. We grease up. Surprise! Beat the crap out of her.
I don't hate it.
Vegas it is.
So have bridesmaids' duties just become out of control? I mean, once, right? It was just you organise a long, tacky stretch limo, you know, maybe a nightclub, possibly a stripper. I don't know whether that happens anymore. But now the duties are months of work, thousands of dollars, and a constantly pinging WhatsApp group. Being a bridesmaid is pretty much a full-time job. Annie Joy Williams is the assistant editor at The Atlantic and has been writing, purging is another word, Annie, about, I guess, just the responsibility of being a bridesmaid now. Has it become out of control?
You know, that, first of all, thank you for having me. That is the question. Have we reached peak bridesmaid? I surely hope so. What got me writing on this topic was that I've been in a wedding every year for the past 7 years, and it's been over $2,500 per wedding just to be a bridesmaid. And, you know, that's added up to almost $20,000 in my 20s that I've spent on other people's weddings. And it got me thinking, you know, maybe I'm not alone.
So hang on. So you've been to a wedding every year for the last 7 years?
Yes, been in, like, a bridesmaid in one of those weddings, yep. Mm-hmm.
So there was this wonderful piece in the piece that you wrote in The Atlantic. There was this one bit where you were talking about, you know, how it used to just be really simple. You maybe go out and you do some shots. But now being a bridesmaid has kind of turned into an 18-month affair that features anything and everything from a four-day retreat, you know, $800 gowns. And it's pretty much just become an unpaid part-time job of just monitoring group chats and coordinating it all. Can you say no, do you think?
You know, that is the question. I think a lot of pushback I've gotten, you know, especially from my male friends who might not have been in such delicate situations like this, they've said, well, you know, this is a self-inflicted wound. You can just say no. And I wish it was that easy. I think what people don't understand is if you say no to one friend, you kind of have to say no to every friend from there on out, or it's kind of like they're assessing where they fall in your ranks. It's super delicate because it's someone's special day. But the whole culture has gotten so expensive that, you know, I wonder if it's not on the bridesmaids to say no, but maybe the bride to lead the charge on curbing some of those costs for their friends.
I'd love to know if this is an Australian thing as well as an American issue. 1-300-222-774. If you've been asked to be a bridesmaid and if it felt like a part-time job, if it was emotionally and financially taxing and just out of reach for you, 1-300-222-774. Annie Joy Williams, the assistant editor at The Atlantic, is with you. What I found incredible, Annie, was through some of your research, you found that Gen Z and millennials in the States have actually made some kind of housing sacrifice, so either living in a smaller apartment or bringing in a flatmate in order to be able to afford other people's weddings.
Yeah, that was the most shocking fact to me as well. Yeah, a recent report from Zillow found that the typical wedding combined cost of going to one bachelorette party and one wedding is over $2,000, which is about the same as the average monthly rent in America. So they also found that half of Gen Z and millennials have made sacrifices, whether it be living with an extra roommate or renting a smaller apartment, just to be able to go to celebrate someone else's wedding, which is so remarkable to me.
Is this a post-COVID thing, do you think?
You know, I do think we saw a little bit of paring back during COVID. You know, you really had to think about who you were inviting to and including in your weddings. And I think people got really excited when we were able to do big events again. And it seems like that hasn't really died down. It's really just grown since maybe 2021 or 2022 when people were finally allowed to have those big gatherings again.
The idea of there being a bridesmaid for the bridesmaid, so a support person for the bridesmaid, please tell me that's not a real thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the honorary bridesmaids, yes. It's crazy. So to me, this is like the biggest insult. It's to ask kind of your second-tier friends to pay up for the bachelorette trip, to, you know, incur a lot of these costs. But then when it comes to the actual wedding day, they're relegated to the role of just guests, and they sit in the audience like everyone else or in the pews like everyone else. But they, you know, help bring those costs down on the bachelorette. But it's really odd because you're a bit out of place. You're not quite a bridesmaid. You're just kind of adding, you know, your financial share to it. It's a bit insulting in my opinion.
So what's the most you've been asked to do? What's the most extreme thing that you've had to do?
You know, I think this is very common, but I just do find it so bizarre. I've been asked to pay my own way for, you know, hair and makeup on the day of the wedding, about $300 usually. And, you know, I say, I'd love to do my own hair. I can match the makeup artist's makeup. I can, you know, go for the similar look. And it's just kind of like very heavily encouraged, and they don't really give you an option not to do it, but they're not paying for it either. And I'm like, I don't want to pay $300 for someone to give me like clown makeup on your wedding day. So that's a common request, but it's outlandish to me.
Georgie wants to know if how many of the last 7 years, how many of these couples whose weddings you've spent a fortune on, are they all still together?
You know, that's a fabulous question. So I'm only 27 years old. So for now, everyone is still together. We'll give it 10 years and see.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I know I organized limos and lunches and all sorts of things. And at the time, I thought I was being really fancy and posh. And now it seems like that's just the standard. Annie, thank you so much for joining us from the States. I really enjoyed reading your piece.
Thank you so much. You have a good one.
You too. That's Annie Joy Williams, who's the assistant editor at The Atlantic. You can have a read of that if you want to. Lots saying, let's not forget the wedding tax for you if you're single. Your single friends are expected to up the ante with good gifts and paying for accommodation, etc. And you don't have anyone to share the costs with a partner. You don't have a partner to share the costs with. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.